Welcome to the Performance Baseball Podcast, talking about youth baseball coaching and player development. Our goal is to equip coaches and parents to win on and off the field. We are your hosts, Adam Young
and Josh Riley.
Like, subscribe, and comment, and if you ask a question in the comments, we'll do our best to answer it.
Now, let's go to the show.
All right, welcome back to the Performance Baseball Podcast. We are here today. We're joined by Joe Haddix. He is the high school baseball coach, head baseball coach at Moore High School in Oklahoma, just outside Oklahoma City. And we are excited to you're our first guest. You should feel privileged.
I do. Yeah, I feel honored. Yeah, I'm excited.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you, Joe. Like we said, you know, Joe's the head coach at a major school here in Oklahoma, 6A school. It's a, you know, it's, if you're not familiar with it, it's a, you know, 6A is the biggest, you know, biggest division you have in Oklahoma. So they're competing against a lot of other big schools around the state. But yeah, we'll get into all that.
Yeah, really excited to have you. We when we started out this podcast, one of our goals was to have some conversations with high school baseball coaches because I'm a youth baseball coach. He's a youth baseball coach, and I want more perspective on like what are high school baseball coaches looking for out of players so that I can do a better job as a coach preparing them for, you know, what y'all are looking for.
Sure.
And what y'all are needing. So that was kind of the idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, like, you know, I'd love to get to know you and, you know, let our listeners get to know you a little bit better. So I know you started out at Wichita State, you know, in college, but we'd love to hear about, you know, kind of your background in baseball, your playing career, you know, highlights or, you know, whatever it is. So, yeah, if you want to tell us a little bit about your history.
Sure, yeah. So I graduated from Moore, actually, in 2012 and signed with Wichita State and was there for 2 years. My freshman year, I got to play for the longtime legendary coaching staff, Gene Stevenson, Brent Chemnitz, Jim Thomas, all the guys who were responsible for all of the success of that program over the first 30 plus years that they were there. And that was a great experience. And we went to a regional my freshman year. We won the conference and I got to contribute in a meaningful way that year, and it was fun. Probably one of the best years, baseball wise, life wise. I met some great guys who are still friends to this day. And then our coaching staff kind of got turned upside down, and
that sucks.
it does. And Gene was so special because he was at that age, and is still getting after it now, but he was at that age where every now and then he would say something that didn't make a whole lot of sense, but was always very good and consistent about making sure that you knew that he believed in you and
that's awesome.
That he had brought you there, got you there for a reason. And,
what position did you play?
I was an outfielder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, that was always big for me as a player. I felt like I played harder and better, more confidently with him and for him because of those reasons. Mm-hmm. And it felt like that was a universal thing amongst our team. And, you know, we had a great time. We had the freedom to be ourselves in the dugout and on the field. And I think it contributed to a lot of our success that year. We had a more talented team the next year and it was that coaching staff just had a different approach. And I don't think it meshed well with,
gotcha.
You know, you have a new coaching staff, you have a bunch of guys who they didn't recruit that they're having to coach, and it just didn't mesh well that year. And
different philosophy, so, different values.
Yeah, and looking back for me personally, I could have met that challenge head on a little bit better than I did.
Yeah.
And I kind of withdrew into myself a little bit that year, and it was not a good year for me. So I made the decision to transfer to Oklahoma City University and play for Coach Crayball and Coach Keith Lytle and two other legends of the game.
Yeah.
And that was a great decision for me. That's where I met some of my best friends, you know, guys who were in my wedding and I was in theirs, and we still communicate regularly to this day. But got to play for a number one ranked team my junior year. Postseason didn't go the way we wanted it to, but man, it was fun. two of the best years of my life, those 2 years. And so I finished playing. I had a very unspectacular playing career.
Sure.
I always tell my players, every player I've ever had, is I prided myself on being a really good teammate. And you know, where I didn't always have success on the field, I made sure that I was consistent in being being a good teammate regardless of my performance, you know. And so I transitioned pretty much instantly into coaching, and I was where you guys were as a youth coach, and did that for 4 or 5 years. And
were you coaching with Sandlot, is that right?
So I started with Premier OKC Athletics. Okay. Okay. and
they switched over to Sandlot, right?
Right. So Nate Dion, who he's from UConn, was a longtime scout for the Braves and the Phillies, started that organization right as I was coming out of playing. And their first full season I coached was responsible for the 13U team.
Nice.
And we had a really good group, and those guys are all sophomores in college now, which is cool. But I, over the course of the next 2 or 3 years, took on some more responsibility within the organization, and started helping in terms of like operations and
nice.
Making sure as we were growing that you know, our coaches were doing their jobs, practices were running smoothly, and because we really focused on the development, and our guys would go twice a week and we would get after it. And so I had my own team, and then I had 5, 6 up to, I think we ended up having 10 teams 1 year. I was kind of responsible for overseeing every other coach that we had.
Wow.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a great thing. And a lot of things that were out of our control ended up contributing to us having to merge with Sandlot Tulsa, which is, they're an incredible organization. Mm-hmm. Great dudes, great baseball dudes who are really invested in the players in the Tulsa area. And it shows that they do a great job. And I got to coach and work for them for a season. And that was a great experience as well. And that's after that year with Sandlot is when I transitioned to the high school side nice. Of things. And Coach Kevin James, who was the head coach at UConn at the time, had been there for about 17 years, gave me an opportunity to come on and be on staff with him. I got certified to teach and started teaching, and learned a lot that year at UConn. Was on the JV staff there. Was fortunate to be around some really good players and good coaches there. And then the opportunity at Midwest City came available, and so I applied to be the head coach at Midwest City. I was fortunate to get that job, and man, I grew more in 2 years there than I had in the 7 years previously as a coach.
Yeah.
You know, the opportunity there to make mistakes and learn how to be a head coach without the pressure of expectation.
Sure.
Was really nice. And we were fortunate to have some good players there too. And our first year was a big time transition year in terms of culture expectations, you know, setting the standard of what should be expected out of a baseball player and out of a team, right? And the way that they carry themselves and handle themselves on and off the field. That first year was a big transition, but a lot of those guys came back for year two, and we were able to hit the ground running. We won 22 games, which hadn't been done in a long time there, and we were on the doorstep of the state tournament. And, you know, we're in the driver's seat in our regional, and we ended up getting beat twice, and that's just how baseball goes sometimes. It didn't roll our way for a couple of days in a row, and a really good team, really fortunate to be a part of that.
Yeah.
And I did not think that the Moore job would be available this quickly, but it came available, and even then I still struggled because, you know, I had an attachment to Midwest City and those guys. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more it felt like a no-brainer to...
And that was your alma mater.
Yeah. Right, yeah, and it felt like a no-brainer to pursue that. It felt like the right time. Sure. And, you know, fortunate that it worked out, and that's where I'm at. And, man, it's been such a blessing to be there.
And you're in your...
This is my first year.
Oh, this is your first year. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So, we open up tomorrow.
All right.
It's opening day.
Who you guys open to?
Duncan.
Duncan. Okay, cool. Yeah.
So awesome. They are. They're super talented. They'll be a favorite in 5A. So it should be a really, really competitive game. But
cool.
It's been really cool to be back home and walk the same hallways I did 12 years ago. And the facilities are spectacular, top notch. We just got a brand new multi-purpose facility for all the sports that all
the teams can use. You were telling me about that a couple weeks ago. The multi-purpose facility. I mean, it's a very large indoor turf,
70-yard turf field. Has baseball lines on it, so we can use it. And then the weight room is good for like 120 kids.
That's awesome.
It's top. I don't know if there's a better. I don't know if there's a better high school facility in Oklahoma for sure, and it rivals some of the college facilities. It's really good for our players.
That's awesome.
It's been a game changer for us,
especially stepping in as the first year head coach in that role at that school at Moore, and then stepping into brand new facilities like that. I'm sure that's just a dream come true. Just having tools at hand to utilize for your players.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's very exciting.
Yeah, and I mean we're full turf too, so the field maintenance aspect of it is a lot less. It's much better.
No more raking dirt lines and all that.
Right.
Staying 20 minutes late.
Yeah.
To rake lines. Yeah.
Or having to watch the weather quite as closely.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. What was it like stepping onto Eck Field or Eck Stadium at Wichita?
I just remember feeling a huge sense of pride wearing that uniform.
Yeah.
The alumni base is so rich there.
Sure.
And so, taking the field there, playing in that stadium, which is an incredible place to play.
Yeah.
It was intimidating, for sure, at first. But, man, it really grows on you, and the people in Wichita are incredible.
That's fantastic.
Facilities there, it was getting to meet some big-time names.
Yeah.
Mike Pelfrey and Charlie O'Brien and some of the guys that were still playing when I was in college, Andy Dirks and Connor Gillespie, and those guys were still in the big leagues coming back and over break. And it's cool to see, to talk to those guys, hear their stories, learn from them.
Yeah.
Really cool, for sure.
That's awesome. Yeah, X Stadium was awesome. We took our 15U team up there last summer. It was fantastic. I had no idea. I've heard it's a great stadium, but stepping on there, if you're not familiar with it, guys, it's got the press box that's very similar to a Fenway setup where the press box is really tall, just monstrous. It was 100% field turf at the moment. I don't know if it was for you.
Yes, it was.
But it was field turf. It's got the big yellow jacket or the
– The shocker.
The shocker right shocker, in the middle. Yeah, right in the middle of the center field is beautiful. It is a beautiful experience.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about, you're in your first season. You're getting ready for your first game. What would you say defines your coaching philosophy, and what are you trying to communicate? How are you trying to communicate that to your new players?
Yeah, for us, it's been about communication, punctuality, physicality, and buying into those things. And so, with our guys, it was you need to learn how to communicate with your coaches. You need to learn how to communicate with your teachers. We're going to be students first. We're going to buy into the weight room because, every college coach that I listen to, every college coach that we talk to, that's one of the first things they mention about, if you want to get here and you want to play early and you want the opportunity to step on the field as a freshman, you've got to be physically ready to do so.
Yeah.
So it's taking care of your schoolwork, buying into the weight room, making good choices in your social life, and taking pride in making sure that you're on time and doing everything right, whether it's the way that you get dressed, the way you play catch, the way you stretch.
Yeah.
We always tell them, and we harp on it, it feels like weekly, if it's on the practice plan, it's because it matters. And anywhere from our pre-practice meeting to our stretching to our post-practice meeting, it's all on the schedule. It all matters. And if it didn't matter, it wouldn't be on the practice schedule. So for us as a team, those are the things that we talk about consistently. We want to be fearless, aggressive, relentless base runners. And that's been at the top of our priority list from day one. And we're starting to see that show up in scrimmage season. But just the ability to pitch to pitch, be able to take bases, and then, you know, when the ball's in play, being able to run the bases.
Yeah.
Both of those things combined just help us, you know, add an extra layer to our offense, right? Because in 6A, like you mentioned, there are some horses, and it's going to be really hard to score runs by just stringing hits together.
Yeah. So, especially by being aggressive like that, you just pressure the defense. You have to make them make good throws or make good plays to handle that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
How do you teach that? How do you develop that culture of aggressiveness from, you know, practice from day one on?
So first it starts with us as coaches telling them it's okay to get thrown out.
Yeah.
And for us, it's important that we foster that environment, because the fear of being thrown out is the one thing that keeps guys from running most consistently.
Mm-hmm.
So we tell them, especially right now when we're doing inter squads and then we're scrimmaging other teams, like, go get thrown out as much as you can, because it doesn't matter. This is the time to work on it. Go figure out where we need to get better. Let's evaluate, you know, every rep. Like, why did you get thrown out there? You know, what didn't work on this one, and what did work whenever you were safe, you know, whenever you stole third or you stole second safely. Yeah. But just, you know, fostering the environment of fearlessness, because they're not afraid of getting yelled at or screamed at if they get thrown out, or even if they screw something up. Like yesterday, we scrimmaged Mustang, and one of my guys stepped off the bag and tried to peek at me in the third base box while he was getting his lead and got picked off. I didn't yell. All I did was, in the next half inning, made sure. I was like, hey, what are you looking at when you step off the bag? Well, I was peeking at you. Well, don't do that.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
Let's look at me when we're on the bag, and as soon as we are no longer on the bag, let's make sure that our eyes are always on the baseball.
And that goes back to make good choices.
Yeah, it's just, but it's having conversations and making sure that they can hear you and not hear your message and not just the volume level of your voice. But then it's training it, right? And we do some sort of base running every single day for anywhere from 15 to 25, maybe 30 minutes, depending on how well they do it. Mm. And so we have...
What does some of that look like?
Yeah, so we do a lot of steel start work, running mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
And I use a lot of Matt Tallarico. He's he was the base running coordinator for the Yankees. I think he still is. He has a website called steelbases.com, but I've listened to him, a couple of his presentations, just on mechanics and what that should look like and what they should be feeling. So we talk about, you know, our first steps, not necessarily being quick steps, but being powerful steps, and trying to gain ground as much as we can in those first four or five steps. Shin angles and, you know.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Body, posture, all that
shin
stuff.
Shin angles, yeah. Absolutely.
The biggest thing, though, is the way that we get our leads is structured and designed to where they always know exactly where they're at. So most of the time, if we're getting a three foot lead, you know, we have all these hybrid leads and hybrid shuffle steel methods that guys teach. And so if we're doing one of those shuffle steel leads or a hybrid lead and that's a 3 foot lead, they know it's a left foot off the bag and one inward turn, and they're at 3 feet. If it's a 6 foot lead, they know they go right, left, turn in, and they're at 6 feet. And so if it's an even numbered foot lead, they start with their right foot off the bag. If it's odd numbered, they start with their left, and that way they always know where they're at. And if they're at six and they shuffle once, they know they're in between 10 and 12. So
now what are the different situations that you're utilizing all those different leads?
So our goal is to give them as many tools as possible in the toolbox, because there are going to be guys that are extremely difficult to run on, even for our best runners.
Mm-hmm.
So shuffle steel is usually designed for, you know, the guys that are the pitchers that are quicker to the plate, or the catcher that's got a better arm. We want to be able to put ourselves in a position to have a little bit of a head start or a little bit of momentum, right? Or we may use it for a guy who's a good base runner, but a little bit slower. And most of the time, our slow guys are the ones who do it the best. But it gives them a little bit of a head start. And we'll time them. We time them from their standard 12-foot lead on a straight steal at a second, and then we'll time them on a shuffle where that right foot on the shuffle hits at 12 feet, and that's when we start the clock and they steal. And they see, hey, that shaves about 2/10 of a second off of my steal start time.
Wow. And when are they starting the shuffle? When do you typically
kind of
start
so
the shuffle?
So it's it's anticipatory, right? So, like, for we're trying to figure out patterns, obviously, always when it comes to the pitchers, whether it's, you know, he takes a breath and his shoulders drop and he goes, or if he's a two-look guy, or we use our own kind of UCLA system. We just call it Lions, and we do an L, I. We count the dashes in between two. So we'll go L, dash, I, dash, O, dash. That way they have it's not necessarily he's an O guy. He may be – if he's an O guy, we're going to go on the dash, but we're going to shuffle on the dash between I and O, right?
That's awesome that you implemented that yourself. Yeah. Like, we use the UCLA system, but, like, yeah, Lions.
Okay, I'm clueless. What's the UCLA system?
It's just more of like a timing mechanism. But, right. I mean, heck, you use it pretty regularly, so go ahead.
Yeah, so pitcher comes set. He pauses. You start to count, and it's U, C, L, A. And if he goes on L every time, well, that's an L guy. Right.
Gotcha. So then you pick up the pitchers on a rhythm.
So I want to try to anticipate the L. So I'll try to steal in between C and L. Right. I'll try to make my move in between C and L. But so we use Lions and we made it our own, and we added the dash because when you do like L, I, and he's going in between L and I, we need something there to as a timing mechanism. Right.
I like the dash.
So if he's an I guy, then I'm going to go L dash bang. I'm gone. Before I get to I, right? Or L dash, I'm into my shuffle because I want that right foot to be hitting as his foot picks up, right?
That's awesome.
And it's, you know, Matt Tallarico, I've listened to a lot, and then Mike Roberts, this is Brian Roberts, his dad, a longtime coach on the East Coast, was at North Carolina for a long time. He teaches it to his guys, and if you go watch, like, Brian Roberts, the way that he stole bases, it was very diverse. It was dynamic. He had all kinds of different ways that he was stealing second. And right now the Yankees do it. If you like Anthony Volpe, he's great at it. And obviously it's easier now at the big league level with the, you know, the requirements in terms of you only have this many disengagements and this many pickoffs and stuff like that. But it just gives those guys an extra little more momentum towards second base. Yeah. And it's When it's done well and done right, it's borderline indefensible.
Gotcha.
But we don't make our guys do it. It's like we have guys that will just be old school and get out to 12 and go.
Gotcha.
Do you pretty much say you've got the green light, you go whenever you want, or are you calling for steals?
Both. So like at second base when we're trying to steal third, we're working momentum constantly. And we work the same type of shuffles, just a little bit more freely in between 15 and 20 feet in that range, and they're always working momentum, and if they time it right, they can go.
Yeah.
And are
you doing the, like, take a couple steps back away from the second base to get kind of back behind the shortstop and then coming forward, or how are you
teaching? A little bit.
We don't necessarily teach
depth. We mostly just get the lead off the back of the base straight toward third. And then they're just working in a straight line toward third base.
Okay.
You know, we let them, whenever the pitcher picks up the plate, they're shuffling toward third. When he looks back, they may give a jab step back. It's more of an illusion, like, okay, I'll move back for you, when we're not really moving back that much.
Because you've already taken the shuffles.
Right. So they have a green light given situations. You know, we have conversations about that. When is the wrong time? When is the right time? At first base, I'll call steals, but I'll also just give them. I have a green light sign. I'll just give them green light sometimes. Where I feel like the green light's easier for some guys because they don't want to feel the pressure of, okay, he gave me steal. I have to go.
Right. Right.
But for some guys, I have no problem doing that too. But with those steal start times, they have a good idea of where they're at and what is average and what's above average, and our above average guys are pretty much green all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we scrimmaged the other day, and we played with the green light idea. My boys really liked it.
Yeah.
Like, that was cool.
Their time.
It's just, you know, trust yourself and believe in yourself and go for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I like to switch gears real quick, and, like, so obviously being a head coach, you wear lots of different hats. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from managing the game day lineups, practice plans, eligibility. You also say you teach two classes as well. Like, how do you wear those different hats, and how do you find balance with all that?
Yeah, well, I have to be a teacher first. It comes with the territory. It's kind of it's what gives me the opportunity to coach. So, I teach. I'm a special education teacher, so it comes with a lot more, you know, paperwork, meetings, different things that, you know, regular education teacher may not have to deal with as consistently. So I deal with that. I teach, like you said, two classes. It's two sections per class, so I have four total classes. I'm done at 12:20 every day, which is nice. So I have lunch, and it backs right into my plan period, so I have time to plan practice and prep for practice and get things ready to go and everything like that. But yeah, I mean, it's managing eligibility for our players, like you said, and that's part of we have our guys sign contracts, and that's number one on the contract is maintain a 3.0. and we weren't perfect, but I think it did help guys in terms of, you know, having a goal for some of them to reach or to maintain. But yeah, we're regularly checking that. We have some help from the athletic department when it comes to that too. They'll send us reports weekly,
okay,
which is nice. But it's, for me, I want to be proactive. I mean, because what I've learned is some of these guys forget to check, or they think they have more time than they do. And so I like to stay on top of some of the ones I know are going to be borderline or are going to have trouble. I like to be proactive with them and making sure I'm checking in with them and checking their grades myself and be like, hey, you have this coming up. Are you ready? Or you've got this to turn in. Or you're really close. You're flirting with not being able to play next week. Let's make sure we stay on top of it. Practice planning. And I try to do that at the beginning of the week for the whole week. That way I only have to do it once. And what I found and learned is that it makes it so much easier to adjust when the plan is already made. And so I can make the plan on a Sunday night or a Monday morning, and it may look completely different by the time we get to Thursday. But having the plan in place, it makes it so much easier to move things around and adjust once it's established. Sure. So that's been really good. And I was a terrible practice planner for a long time. And I've had to, you know, learn from other coaches and kind of teach myself how to be more efficient and get more done in a shorter amount of time, because we could be there all day.
Yeah.
But it's that. It's.
Now, how detailed do you get on that? Are you putting times down and all that?
Or? Yes. Yeah. Now, do I adhere to those times?
Not always.
Rarely, I would say. But I always try to bake in, you know, some extra 5 minutes here, extra 5 minutes there. Mm-hmm. And then I have been in charge. I put myself in charge of our strength program and speed program too. So every Monday I put the plan together for that also. Whether it's the lifts or the, you know, our sprints and jumps that we do a couple of times a week.
Are you lifting every day? Or
so in the off season we lift four times a week. We go Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. We have a movement day built in. And then and we sprint and jump twice a week, and it's usually before we lift legs. And then once the season starts, so right now I think it was last week we transitioned to in season, and we'll go 3 days a week and sprint and jump twice a week. So yeah, it's been a game changer, that portion of it, for our players, because you know, a lot of guys have put on 20, 25 pounds in the last 6 months, and they're starting to love it.
That's awesome.
Because they're seeing those gains. It's really fun. So,
like, with those gains, they're probably getting more powerful. They're probably hitting the ball. What's their biggest notice when they start putting on muscle?
I think more than anything, it's they don't feel tired or fatigued as easily. Mm-hmm. We have some guys that have made some big jumps in the way that they impact a baseball, for sure. But I think the biggest thing, and really it's impacted our team speed too. We have a lot of guys who can run, and a couple of them who didn't used to be able to. So it's been fun for sure. But yeah, it's that. It's I have a really big coaching staff. I'm fortunate, extremely fortunate. I have 7 assistants total, which we have 3 teams. So it gives us 4 full-time varsity coaches, 2 JV coaches. We have 2 JV teams, so 2 gotcha. JV coaches, JV1 coaches, and 2 JV2 coaches. But
like, how hands-on are you with them and their teams? Are you super involved, or are you kind of like, hey, go do it and report back, or you know, that kind of thing?
All fall, we are all together, basically up until we can fully practice. And so all 3 teams, all 4 grades are all together. I think it helps with, you know, freshmen interacting with upperclassmen, sure. and vice versa, you know, being able to learn from older guys and see how they move and what they do and how they approach things. Mm-hmm. And then once December 1st is when we're full go in terms of practice. So once that happens, I kept varsity JV together this year. And we practice together, and our freshman / JV2 team, they do their own thing. Mm-hmm. And I did that because we're super senior and junior heavy. So we have a lot of guys in that junior and sophomore class that will suit varsity and JV.
Mm-hmm.
So we practice together because I think it keeps everybody sharp. I think it elevates both teams. Because it's March 1st is tomorrow, opening day is tomorrow. We still kind of have some active competitions in certain spots.
Yeah.
So I think it's been really beneficial for everybody. But, I mean, when it comes to the, you know, game management and things like that for those other teams, I try to stay hands off because I want those guys to, you know, make those teams their own and learn and, you know, how to manage a game, how to manage players. All of the above without, you know, having the feeling of like I'm breathing down their neck, you know, and that's sure. what, as an assistant, that's what I liked was that, you know, when I was on that JV staff, it was me and the pitching guy who was the JV head coach. We got to do things pretty much how we wanted to do them. And, you know, it gave us the freedom to
mm-hmm.
learn and make mistakes. And because those are, in theory, inconsequential games.
Gotcha.
That we're, you know, the players are learning, we're learning, and I think all of our guys, the coaching staff wise, they all aspire to be either, you know, with the varsity staff or a head coach themselves at some point. And so it's really on me, I think, to make sure that I'm giving them the freedom to go learn how to do it, and then, you know, providing guidance where it needs to be provided, and, you know, hey, here's. You did well. Here's where we can improve, you know, things like that. But I try to stand back and let them coach, and that way they know they have the freedom to do their thing.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do you assign the roles to some of the coaches in the coaching staff? Like, as in, like, your freshmen, do you ever move them up to the varsity realm, or do they pretty much have a job assignment right off the bat when they come in?
With our staff, 5 coaches – 5 of the 7 that I hired were already on staff at Moore. And then I hired 2 additional that were not on the previous staff. So the 3 guys who were full-time varsity guys last year, I kept as full-time varsity guys this year. The other 2 were together with our freshman group last year. So I assigned one of them the head JV coach position, and the other one is now the head freshman. He was the freshman assistant. So, yeah, I can, you know, play around with it and bring guys up. And so, like, our JV staff, if the JV group's not playing or they're playing after us, they'll be in the dugout with us helping. I have, you know, one's a pitching guy, so he'll assist with my pitching coach, and the other one's an infield guy and a smart one. And so he takes care of a lot of our infield stuff regardless of team. Just in terms of preparation, so I like him to be in the dugout too because he's really good about communicating with our infielders in between pitches and in between hitters. So, yeah, I mean it's we're flexible. We're at any point in time we may have 8 coaches in the dugout, you know. But yeah. Whether it's me in one of their dugouts or they're in ours, you know. So it's fluid. The guys understand, you know, their roles and responsibilities for sure when it comes to practice and games. But I want them to be able to experience all of it. for sure.
How much are you, as a high school coach, focused on player development, getting them ready for the next level, versus winning games?
I think they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
I am gung-ho about making sure that we are developing and preparing our players for college baseball. And our varsity guys, at least. And the guys that are coming in, the young guys, it's preparing them for step one. It's preparing them for them to play at the varsity level. And then step two, it's preparing them to play at the next level if that's what they want to do.
Yeah.
So it's number one, let's provide expectations. Let's show them what college baseball players look like, what they do, you know, what their routines look like. Let's tell them what the expectations are of college coaches and what they're looking for. And then let's go train it.
Yeah.
And you know, hey, this is what you look like. This is what the freshman All-American looks like. Or this is what the guy looked like who's was here. You saw last year as a senior, this is what he's doing as a freshman at such and such place, wherever he's at, you know.
Do you have any of those guys come back?
Yeah, I was fortunate. At Midwest City, I had a player named Brian Williams. He is now a freshman at Dallas Baptist. And, you know, they're nationally ranked.
Yeah, really good team.
Powerhouse program down there. They really teach guys how to hit. They develop hitters well. He came back and spent some time with us over Christmas break, and so
that's great.
They had an opportunity to, you know, hit alongside him, work out alongside him, and then, you know, listen to him say, kind of echo some of the things that we talk about in terms of the physicality aspect, because he said that was the biggest hurdle for him, and he was one that we, you know, we worked hard to prepare physically, and still, you know, noticed that was the biggest difference when it comes to high school and college players is the physicality of the sport, and the players is just on another level. So yeah, I mean, it's our goal, yes, is to win games. That's my job, right? It's part of my job. But I think more important than that, it's, you know, I want to be known for, you know, his players are always prepared. They're always ready to step in and play whenever they show up, you know? So that's, I think they go hand in hand. I really do. But, you know, I think it's important for us to, you know, prioritize time for both of those things for sure.
What is the interaction like for you as a high school coach with the boys on your team, travel teams, and they're like their summer league teams? What is that relationship like, or is there a relationship there between you and some of those coaches?
So I don't with my more players, I haven't really had that much of an opportunity yet. At Midwest City, I didn't have that opportunity ever. A lot of my guys were not travel baseball players.
It
was just a different community, different type of kid. And so here it's a lot of my guys play for the Ryzen organization, and those coaches are all high school coaches.
Oh, okay.
So I know a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
I have a handful of guys that play for one of our alumni who was class of 99 and played college ball, played some pro ball, and now coaches about four or five of them. And so one of them is his kid, and his kid, he's our shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a relationship there, obviously, because I'm coaching his kid, but I'm also coaching four of his players that play for him in the summer. Yeah. So,
sure.
I think for me, the priority there has always been about having open lines of communication about expectations, right? And whether it's, you know, load management for pitchers or, you know, what are your expectations for this guy on the bump? Or, hey, he threw 50 innings this spring. Maybe take it easy on him this summer.
Sure.
You know, whatever that looks like, just making sure that there is an open line of communication, because I think where the adversarial relationship becomes a thing is when the communication has to go through the player or has to go through a parent, and things get misconstrued or misunderstood, and then we're butting heads when we shouldn't be. And I've been on both sides of it, and so I have a little bit of a unique perspective.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking.
I will never approach that, you know, from a adversarial perspective of we're enemies, you know, because at the end of the day, we should be both about the same exact thing. And, right. and it's developing said player to get ready to play at the next level and doing our best collectively to find him a place to play or to help him find a place to play.
Yeah, gotcha. When you're putting together your teams, when it's like tryout season, do you make all your existing players try out for the following year? Do you have one mass big tryout? And also, how do you select players for your teams?
So Moore Public Schools is a no-cut district.
Okay.
So,
interesting.
We don't have designated tryouts per se. It's more of a one big evaluation period. And so we're communicating with the players throughout the course of that, like, hey, maybe once or twice in the fall, this is where you're at. This is where you need to get to. At the end of the fall, hey, here's
– And who's doing that communication? Are you doing all that? Are your coaches helping you with
that? It's a collective effort.
Yeah.
Since we're all together, I want to make sure, you know, whoever has input, that they make sure that they give that input. But it's setting the expectation and then – reminding them where they're at, you know, giving them some sort of plan on how to improve the things that we think they need to improve upon. And then as we get closer to the season, it's, hey, this is what you can expect this spring. And there were a handful of guys that have no chance of seeing the field, and it's just because they don't have any present skill. And whether it's because this is their first year playing or they're new to the game relatively, it's one of those things where you're going to get hurt out here, and we have guys that need more reps, so we're going to mm-hmm. restrict your practice time. We can't cut you. We're going to restrict your practice time, and we have to do it that way.
Yeah.
So, but again, I think, again, it's communication, right? Setting the expectation. I don't ever want a kid to be in the dark about why he's where, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, it's one big evaluation period, and yes, when it comes to, you know, the full scope of things, we reevaluate everybody every year. And there are guys this year that are playing and are going to have full-time roles that were nowhere on the radar in August.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it's fun. I love it. It's super competitive, and especially at a 6A program, we have a lot of guys. There's dudes that step up in random spots or seniors that never have had an opportunity have now, you know, grown physically and improved, and they're, you know, getting those opportunities now because they've worked hard for them. So it's cool.
When assigning like the varsity role to your players, is skill alone the biggest leading factor in their assignment to the varsity, or is there more that contributes to it?
I think it has to be the biggest contributor. That being said, there are guys who could be addition by subtraction when it comes to their attitude and the way that they carry themselves in the dugout and, you know, the way that they talk. We're fortunate to not have any of those guys. But, you know, on the other side of it, we got great kids who work really hard who aren't very good, and they're not going to see the field, you know. And it's not because they're not good kids and not because they're not good students. They're not that skilled. And now – is there a place for a guy like that in the dugout? Absolutely. You know, I think when it comes to having good teammates, like we talked about just a little bit ago, I think that is a super undervalued skill. So now we're going to try to teach all of our players, regardless of skill, how to be a good teammate and try to show them what that looks like. But it is important for the guys that don't see the field as much, maybe more important for those guys to be good teammates and not take away from what we're trying to accomplish, because – they're the ones that voices are heard in the dugout most often, because that's where they spend most of their time. So, yes, skill is – it has to be at the top of the list, but it can't be the only criteria.
Sure.
For sure.
For an infielder, what are you looking for skill-wise? Like what kinds of things are you looking for to say, okay, you're going to – you're going to make the field, you're going to get on the field, and you're not? Like, what are some of those factors?
Athleticism, first and foremost.
Yeah.
Do his hands and his feet work well together? Can he make the throw consistently? What's the arm strength like? Yeah. Like, you know, how rangy is he? Is he a corner guy or a middle guy? And then it's, what's situational awareness like? You know, how does he communicate with everybody else? Does he know where to be? Does he know where the ball needs to go? things like that. But yeah, first and foremost, it's going to be, you know, is he a good athlete? How do his hands and feet work in conjunction with each other? What's the arm strength like? Can you get the ball across the infield? And then we kind of go from there.
So if you've got a highly skilled guy who's not super athletic versus an athlete, but who maybe hasn't played as much baseball, which one are you taking?
That's a good question. In a vacuum, I would take the guy that's the highly skilled guy.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
In a vacuum. Now, if you give us time to
because you believe that you can help develop the athleticism side of it.
I think we could develop both things. But if like tomorrow I needed to pick a guy, I'm going to pick the guy that I know will make the plays that all the plays he's supposed to make. Right.
Yeah.
Now, having the project of this guy's an incredible athlete, let's teach him, you know, how the hands and feet are supposed to work. Let's bear down on the fundamentals and show him what it looks like to field a ground ball and throw across the infield. Absolutely. Because we don't ever want to take the athleticism out of a kid. That's something that's, yes, you can teach it, but when a guy shows up with present athleticism, that's fun.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, I think there's a place for both, for sure. And our shortstop is, right now, is a four-sport athlete. He gets after it. And some of the stuff that he does is not stuff that you can necessarily teach.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's a skilled infielder. His hands and feet work. You know, the arm works across the infield. He's 90 across the infield. So.
Yeah. With four sports, what four sports?
Football, basketball, baseball, track.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And how do you, as the baseball coach, balance that with him? And how does he balance that?
Yeah.
Because four-sport athletes are few and far between these days.
And much less at a 6A school.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the do-it-all guy on the football field. He's a defensive back. He's the backup quarterback, slot receiver, punt returner. He does not play basketball anymore, but lettered as a sophomore.
Oh, wow.
And then he's a high jumper. So
okay.
He, as a sophomore last year, played sixth in the state in 6A in high jump. Just pretty incredible. But usually he picks a day a week to go over and jump. He did it Wednesday this week because Wednesday's a day that we don't do a whole lot. It's a light day for us.
So is he just communicating that with you?
Yeah. He's like, hey, can I go jump today? I need to practice. We have a meet in a week. Absolutely. Yeah, no problem. I've also got one that is a thrower. So he'll go and throw once a week, and maybe he won't. Maybe he'll take a week off here and there, but most of the time it's once a week. He goes over there and gets some work in.
Do you communicate what's the preferred sport? So, for instance, if there's a track meet and there's a baseball game on the same day, does that ever happen where there's a conflict? And
yes.
If so, where, like, how does the communication happen?
I've not dealt with it in real time.
Sure.
So, I know with our shortstop, it's going to be, if it ever, like, lined up perfectly where he's supposed to be jumping and the game is going on at the same time, he's going to be at the baseball game.
Sure.
My thrower, I don't know. He's a better thrower than he is a baseball player.
So he may just
That being
the
said,
best.
He spends more time at baseball than he does throwing. So, but I don't know. And I've already communicated with his throwing coach about, you know, this meet lines up to where we're off this day. You know, he can go to these, and these. But this one he's going to miss, this one he's going to miss, or just depending on time, you know, when the event actually is. But
again, how do you feel about multi-sport athletes?
I was one, so I'm all about it.
Yeah, same.
First, I just think it's fun, right? Like I played football, basketball, and baseball. Football games were like my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Friday Night Lights were the best. I just think it's, you know, it's multiple different ways of learning how to be a part of a team in different environments, and I think that can only contribute to being a better teammate. And then there's different, you know, types of athleticism, different movements in the weight room, different sprint and jump type things that you do for different sports that only make you a better athlete, you know? So
yeah.
I'm all for it. I love it.
Awesome.
I tell all of my players, play multiple sports. Go play soccer, go play basketball, whatever it is.
It's such an integral part about the development. You can learn things in other sports that you can't learn in baseball.
Yeah.
It's an awesome thing.
I'm a big believer in the sport will tell you when it's time to hang it up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. So how, let me ask you this. So since we're more on the youth side, obviously we do have high schoolers in our program, but focusing on the youth side, how can youth development, youth travel organizations, how can we help you out as a high school coach? And what I mean by that is, how could we develop players better so they are ready to rock and roll for you by the time they get to your high school?
I think the biggest thing for me this year is guys don't know how to bunt anymore. And so we've had to really work on bunting fundamentals. And, you know, which side of the field do we need to be bunting to given a certain situation, right?
And how much are you utilizing small ball in your...
A lot.
Yeah.
We have to.
Yeah.
Like I said, we have some really, really good arms we're going to come across on Mondays and Tuesdays this year. We're going to have to find different ways to manufacture runs, and sometimes that's going to mean laying down a bunt. And so...
We've been working a lot on bunting already this.
Yeah, good. So I mean, that's encouraging. We're teaching a lot of guys who are juniors and seniors how to bunt.
Wow, and that's wild to me.
Yeah,
it's become a
home run ball.
It's become part of the old school tag, right? Yeah. You know, bunting doesn't really help you. And bottom line is, man, at the highest level of the game, maybe not as much.
Hmm.
Those hitters are the best in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
They're going to hit.
You high school guys are not the best in the world. You know?
Yeah.
And we got to find ways to score runs. So if we've got runners on first and second and nobody out and we have 9 punch outs through 4 innings, we're going to bunt the baseball. If we've got first and third and 1 out and we haven't been able to drive a guy in with a runner on third and less than 2 outs, we're going to bunt a guy in, you know?
Yeah.
And not only that, force high school defenses to make plays, and they're going to make mistakes. So, yeah, bunting to me is the one skill that I think is starting to lose collectively. And then the base running piece too, I think, is another thing we're having to really teach guys what that looks like, you know, with the ball in play, what it looks like to round a bag, all the things that, you know, in between pitches they need to be doing on the bases. Some of that stuff is lacking a little bit. Those are my two key ones for sure. And then it comes down to situational awareness, you know. Cuts and relays, where we're supposed to be when the ball is hit here, where the ball is supposed to go, you know, thinking pre-pitch and learning how to, you know, go through all of those scenarios in your head before the ball is ever put in play.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the three big ones for me when it comes to guys coming up to the high school level, being ready to contribute outside of the physicality piece of it, which mm-hmm. it mostly comes with time and investment. Bunting, base running, situational awareness, for sure.
That's great. All right. I did a little digging on you.
Okay.
I discovered your Twitter feed. And so I thought we'd end with some lighthearted questions.
Sure.
First off, you tweeted a while back that New Girl was the best TV show on television.
Do you still agree with that
statement?
I don't know if I would call it the best. I think it's great.
I freaking love New Girl. Who was your favorite character?
Nick Miller. It's not close.
Yeah.
It's not close.
See, mine was Schmidt.
I like Schmidt.
I was all about Schmidt.
The OCD, yes. Yes.
No, that's funny. I don't even remember tweeting that.
great show. He was digging. You
great
know?
Show. Yeah.
I had some fun.
You had to dig for that one. Great show.
Yeah. That was a fun show. Me and my wife, really. We enjoyed watching that one together. Okay. There's no room for ego in coaching. It's not about us. We had our chance. Tell me about that.
I think it's self-explanatory. I mean, for me, we had our chance to play. My job is not to make me look good.
Yeah.
My job is to make them look good and help them have success. Show them what it looks like. Let them go play. Have a great time doing it. And then lift them up and prop them up and put them on a pedestal when it comes to time for somebody to reap some sort of benefit or credit. It needs to be about our players and never about us as coaches. We need to be taking a step back and being in the background instead of the foreground.
Yeah. I was talking with one of my parents this week, and they left a team because, and I'm not going to name names or anything like that, but because that coach had the opposite of that approach. He said at the end of one of their seasons, they were at their all-team party or whatever, and the coach said, "I just want to thank everybody. You know, this is my chance to get back on the field and blah, blah." And I'm like, it's not about you. It's, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was that guy at 23 and 24 years old.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I had to learn quickly, man, this ain't about you anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Okay. So one quote that actually I think was from your players that were written on a whiteboard. It says, "Don't complain about how much is on your plate when your goal was to eat."
Yes.
Tell me about that one.
That's Alex Garrett. He's one of our juniors. That dude is a program guy through and through. He's a guy that, like, he'll lift twice a day.
That's
awesome. He's an animal. He was like, "Hey, can I write I got a quote. Can I write it on the board?" I'm like, absolutely. And there are very few that I've never heard or never seen, I feel like. Every now and then one comes along, and that one was one that I loved.
Yeah.
So.
Well, unfortunately, our recording cut out. I made a mistake as we were recording this, and we lost about the last 5 minutes of our conversation with Joe. But why don't you and I, Josh, just recap a little bit of what he talked about? Because he mentioned a few things there at the end that I thought were really good.
Yeah. Yeah, the first one, I mean, one of the tweets he had posted was, "You can learn a lot about a team or organization by looking at the dugout after they leave. Respect the game, respect the facility, leave it better than you found it."
Yeah, I think that's a culture thing to me. It's like if you are sloppy in how you take care of your environment, you're probably going to be sloppy on the field too. That also is an indicator that you have not developed leaders on your team. You have not developed some servant leadership on your team either. And so, yeah, I thought he was spot on with that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And he brought up the point that he loves, like, he has no problem with taking away things. So taking away batting practice, taking away a piece of facilities or whatever
running
it is.
Guys.
Running guys. Yeah. Like, yeah, that's where that head coach role comes into play, is just teaching, accountability and owning their space.
Yeah. I really like this one from him. "Nothing is more daddy ball than a first base coach in cargo shorts."
I think he said that goes along the lines with the starter pack, the daddy ball starter pack.
Right.
Man, yes, that sums it up.
That's not a good look. That's not a good look. We can do better.
Yes. This is a sign, no shame if you wear cargo shorts, but just don't wear them on the field.
But also daddy ball in general, of like the coach who is the dad who always plays his son at the primary positions and pitches him every single game, and like that kid is not the best player on the team. Now sometimes the coach's son is the best player on the team, but yeah, that's also daddy ball to me, is that vibe. Not a good vibe. Let's see. The last thing that stood out to me as I was perusing his Twitter feed was he had several different comments of words of support and prayers for different coaches, players, parents of players, in which he expressed his prayers of support for them. And so we got into a little bit of a conversation of how his faith interacts with his coaching. And for me, as pastor being my other job, that was really impactful for me to hear. And one of the main things that he talked about was that he instills that ideal of servant leadership in his team, and holds Jesus up as the example of, mm-hmm. The guy who washed his disciples' feet, who said, the first will be last, the last will be first, and whoever is humble will be first. And so he takes that and instills that idea of being a good teammate and being a servant to all in his teams, which I think is really commendable.
Yeah, and another thing that he honed in on was that your value as a player, as a student athlete, or even as a coach goes far beyond your record, far beyond your skill, your stats. It really is a great thought behind that, especially being a high school coach and the temperature that we're in with high school in general. The temperature that we're in is, so many people are so focused on who am I based on, my stats, how cool I am, wherever
wins
it is.
Wins and losses.
Yeah, wins and losses, that your value is far more focused on you besides those other things.
And that could be a good thing for us as coaches to remember, not letting our egos get in the way of our coaching, of resting in that knowledge that, we are beloved by God, and there's nothing that can change God's mind about us. Our God's mind is made up about us already, and so we can relax. Like it's not the end of the world. We don't have to get so bent out of shape. And a lot of times what that looks like for coaches is anger with players that is unproductive, right? Mm-hmm. There are times when, consequences and frustrations and things like that are warranted by us as coaches. If there's, lack of effort or hustle or not paying attention or whatever it might be. And then there's times where we're just mad because we lost or whatever. Yeah. And we're taking it out unnecessarily on our players. And that's not a good place to be. Yeah. And I really do feel like a lot of times that comes from just a sense of anxiety or not being secure, of insecurity in one's own identity. So I appreciated that word from him as well.
Yeah, and at the very tail end, we asked him, what is one piece of advice that he would give to other coaches? And his thought was, always be learning, continually be learning, always be a student of the game. Once you think you know everything, that's kind of where your career ends. You know, continually be chasing after the knowledge from others.
Yep. Absolutely. It was a great episode. I really enjoyed having Joe on. First guest, our guinea pig.
Yep.
He was a great interview, so that was awesome. So looking forward to the next one. What are we going to be talking about next, Josh?
Yeah, next episode we're going to be talking about
travel ball.
Yes.
And the current culture and climate of youth baseball. This one will get you riled up.
Yes. I look forward to that topic. We'll see you on the next episode.
All right. Sounds good.